Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 20. In our last session, we're racing against the clock, sort of like the one before that, the session before. That's two sessions in a row we ended without quite finishing a chapter. It's not as if we didn't complete a whole chapter. We did, but we completed more than one chapter. But the chapter we were in at quitting time, we didn't finish. And we are now in the midst of the outright persecution of David by Saul. Saul has done a number of things to show his hostility to David, including throwing javelins at him in the palace and setting guards around his house to capture him, to kill him in cold blood, even suggesting when David was purported to be sick in bed, suggesting the bringing of the sick man into the palace in his bed to be killed in cold blood. That didn't happen because David wasn't really in his bed, as it turns out, but imagine if that had really been done. I mean, just think how the citizenry and the servants of Saul would have viewed that situation. Here's a man sick in bed, defenseless, and not a criminal in any way. And the guy just murders him there. And not only not a criminal, innocent man, but a national hero like David. I mean, Saul just was not exactly dealing with a full deck most of the time here because he was really demonized. And much of what he did came from the influence, I think, of the demonic, as well as his own corrupt pride and insecurity. But in chapter 20, David informs Jonathan that Saul is still trying to kill him. At this point, Jonathan had been assured verbally by Saul that he would not kill him. Back in chapter 19, Jonathan had protested to Saul about Saul's attempts on David's life. And in verse 6 of chapter 19, Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." However, it was after that that Saul sent guards to David's house to capture him and kill him, but apparently without telling Jonathan. And so Jonathan is, in chapter 20, unaware that there are continuing attempts against David, and David tells him of it. And Jonathan at first is suggests that this can't be true. Certainly Saul would have told Jonathan. And David says, "No, your father knows that you're on my side, so he doesn't tell you anything anymore." So in order to convince Jonathan that this was true, David said, "Listen, there's a feast. The new moon feast is coming up here, and I'll be expected to be at the royal table as usual. I won't show up. And if Saul asks where I am, just tell him that I've gone to Bethlehem to observe a yearly feast. If that doesn't bother him, then you'll know that I'm wrong, and he's not out to get me. But if it does bother him, if it makes him angry, then you'll know that I'm right, and he is trying to kill me still." So Jonathan agreed to this, and they determined that Jonathan would get back to David about this and tell him what the results were of this experiment. David was to hide by a certain rock, which may have been at the border of the land. That is to say that if the coast was not clear, David could cross. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but it was some particular rock that was chosen for its strategic location. What Jonathan said he would do is he'd come out shooting with a young boy who would to retrieve his arrows, and he'd come near enough so that David could overhear his conversation with the boy, and he'd shoot arrows, and as the boy went looking for them, he'd either say the arrow fell short of that or it went beyond that. And if it were the latter, it would mean that the coast was not clear and that David would have to flee. Now, let's go ahead and read on. We see that Jonathan goes to the meal with Saul. Saul does, in fact, ask where David is, and Jonathan gives the answer that David had suggested they should give in verse 29. And in verse 30, it says, "Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, 'Son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die.'" Now, when Saul said to Jonathan, "As long as David's alive, your kingdom will not be established," this was in outright rebellion against God, because Samuel had told Saul back in chapter 13 that his kingdom was not going to be established, that God had chosen another to replace him, and that his family would not continue to rule. But it's clear that Saul's intention was, by force, to preclude the fulfillment of that prophecy, and to seek to allow his son to take the throne after him and to establish an ongoing dynasty, which Samuel the prophet had already made clear was not what God intended to do. Furthermore, Samuel had announced to Saul in chapter 15 that God had rejected Saul as king. Not only his family line would not continue, but Saul himself was now rejected, and the spirit departed from Saul. But this did not cause Saul to automatically surrender his throne, as would have been seemingly appropriate. Instead, since he had the military on his side, and he had the, the handles of power in his hands, he could illegitimately maintain his hold on his throne. As I said before in our last session, I think Saul and his kingship at this point is a type and a picture of the illegitimate rule of the world and of its rulers, because the Bible says that all authority in heaven and earth has been given to Christ, but certainly not the rulers of the world don't acknowledge this. As it says in Psalm 2, the kings of the earth conspire together against the Lord and against his Messiah. They say, let us cast his cords from us and break his bands on us and so forth. They refuse to submit to the anointed one, the Messiah. David, in this case, was the anointed one. Saul was the rejected king. And he should have, of course, submitted to what the will of God had been announced to be, but he would not. And he resisted David, but to his own undoing, ultimately. And David then, of course, had a few loyal followers that we'll soon read of. And they became his kingdom, as it were, his persecuted kingdom, the secret kingdom, the underground kingdom, until Saul's kingdom collapsed and David was declared universal ruler of the nation and nations beyond as well. The type being, to my mind, an easy one to identify of how Christ today, though anointed by his Father as the true king, is not recognized kings of this earth or by the power structures of this earth. But there are some who do recognize the lordship of Christ and have already established his kingdom in their own lives. They're already loyal to him. It may be, like David's followers at this time, that they will be outcasts. They may even be persecuted, but they remain loyal. And the time will come when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, when Saul is destroyed and David's kingdom is established universally, or, according to the type, when the kingdoms of this world are destroyed at the second coming of Christ. And Jesus takes the kingdom for himself, and those who suffered with him during this time will reign with him at that time, even as David's loyal followers at this time became his cabinet and co-rulers and mighty men at a later time. Now, Jonathan answered Saul in verse 32, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? That was much too reasonable a question to ask. Saul didn't have reason on his side, and so he did what many people do who are challenged with the irrationality of their opinions. He took a spear and hurled it at Jonathan to kill him. In other words, when you can't give a good answer, just resort to violence, you know. And let me just a moment here. Now, Jonathan, of course, having become a target, as David had been, from his father, but only briefly, realized that his father was just as mad and irrational as before. And we read in verse 34, so Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food that second day. That was the second day of the feast when this happened. So instead of eating, he left the table and left his food untouched. For he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. Now, he was grieved for David because David was being mistreated. He must have been awfully ashamed of his father, too. I mean, his father was making a public spectacle of his own insanity. And when your parents do that kind of thing, it's a bit embarrassing. And his father, being king, was the more visible in behavior than if he was an ordinary citizen. Jonathan was ashamed of his father, I think, and also, of course, felt for David. And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. And then he said to his lad, now run and find the arrows I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? Which was the signal that the coast was not clear. And Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. Which had a double meaning. Of course, he was talking to David, the need for him to make haste and not delay and escape with his life. So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go carry them to the city. Now, as soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times and kissed one another, and they wept together, but David more so. Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord be between you and me, and between your descendants, and my descendants forever.'" So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. One question that suggests itself here is, since David and Jonathan were able to just meet and converse like this, what was the signal? I mean, why was it necessary to shoot the arrow and call out to the boy? It seemed as if initially that signal to let him know, in case Jonathan couldn't speak with him directly, that he had to flee. And it's possible that Jonathan and David, in making this countersign or this signal, did so because they weren't sure if the coast would be clear for Jonathan and David to see each other and speak again. So this would be a way that Jonathan would get a message to him if there was no opportunity for them to speak. As it turned out, there was opportunity for them to speak because no one else was around, and the signal could have been avoided. However, there's another possibility, and that is that because David would be hiding in a particular place that even Jonathan wouldn't know where he was, this would be the signal to tell David that for David to reveal himself to Jonathan. But that's not really what they agreed to. They agreed that the signal would tell David whether it's safe to run or not. I mean, safe to stay or whether he should run. And if it was a matter of giving the signal so that David would know that Jonathan wants him to come out and present himself so they can talk, that'd be another story. So I suspect that the signal was arranged for in anticipation of the potentiality that they could not speak, that Jonathan could not rid himself of company and would have to just give a secret message to David. But as it turned out, they were left alone, so they were able to say goodbye to one another. Now, there's something very disappointing about this, the way this chapter ends. It says, so David arose and departed, and at that point, we have the beginning of the official beginning of his flight from Saul, which we don't know how long it lasted. It may have been months. It may have even been more than a year that he fled. It may have been years that he fled from Saul. The Bible doesn't give us information of the exact length of time. But David lived as a refugee and a fugitive and an exile and so forth during this period of time. This is the last line. And Jonathan went into the city. Now, this is a little bit pointing, at least to me. Jonathan has shown tremendous virtue and nobility up to this point. He has surrendered his armor and everything to David on an earlier occasion. He has spoken plainly that he believes that David is to be the next king. And yet he stays with his father Saul. And I think a lot of Christians are in that position too. They're willing to acknowledge that Jesus is the Lord and that he's going to reign and they hope to reign with him someday. But for the time being, they'll stick with the world system. And hopefully reign with Jesus in the next world. Jonathan had that hope, but Jonathan did not realize that expectation. Jonathan died in battle with Saul. He went down with the system that he remained with and never reigned with David, which is tragic and instructive, I think, to those who think that that's the way to live the Christian life, is acknowledge the lordship of Jesus for later and say, yeah, I'm right with you, Jesus, but of course I've got to play the game by the world's rules here, because it's uncomfortable out there in the woods. Jonathan and David did see one another again, and once again Jonathan affirmed his loyalty to David, but he never showed his loyalty by going with David. Now, in Jonathan's defense, I think it should be pointed out that Jonathan, no doubt, because of his loyalty to David, felt like the best thing he could do for David is stay in the palace, that David might need a friend in court, that for Jonathan to flee into the woods and live with David there would be Jonathan's way of losing, surrendering any bargaining power he might ever have in the kingdom with his father or with anyone else. And that as one staying in the kingdom of Saul, he might wield some influence for David's help. I'm sure that Jonathan must have thought that way, though we're not told that he did. But, I mean, Jonathan's loyalty to David just makes it impossible to imagine that he wasn't thinking something like that. The sad thing about it is that he was wrong. He was unable to influence the wicked world for David, and by seeking advocacy for David through the political channel or whatever, he did not succeed in doing anything favorable for David. Instead, he lost his own position and his own destiny and his own relationship with David eventually. I don't know how this might apply, to specific situations today, I do believe a lot of people make the excuse that they are living worldly lives because they hope to win the world for Jesus. That they adopt a worldly culture, they adopt worldly fashions, they adopt worldly means of entertainment, they adopt worldly lifestyles in general. Not outright sinful lifestyles, not such things as you could find a command of God directly against, but plainly, very much tailored to attract the world on its own terms rather than on God's terms. The saddest thing about this is the world gets a message that it has anything at all to offer, which is doubtful, because if the church did have something unique to offer, why would it copy the world? But that if the church does have anything to offer, and if worldly people ought to consider the claims of the church and the gospel, the impression is that they can accept Christ on their own terms. After all, the Christians come to them on their own terms. It seems to me like Christians ought to take a more decided stand to press the claims of Christ and inform people that to come to Christ, one must deny him, must deny the world, must deny his flesh, and must come to Christ on the terms that God sets, not the terms that are most comfortable or most popular. And I think that Jonathan hoped, as many Christians hope, that by being an intricate part of the worldly system, he could be a good witness for David there. But he was unable to change the worldly system as a whole. And if he had run off with David, become part of the mighty men of David, it would have been actually far better, I think, for Jonathan. It might have been far better for David, too. In fact, it might well have been that Saul, the loyalty of Saul's servants would have been divided, realizing that the prince, Saul's son, is with David. It would certainly make it seem almost more legitimate to defect to David's side because you'd have the next king apparent, sponsoring that course of action. Anyway, I don't wish to condemn Jonathan. I'm a little disappointed with the decision, but then I'm a little disappointed with the way some Christians decide about their involvement with worldliness. When I say the world, I'm not talking about necessarily the corporate world. I don't think there's anything wrong with being working for a corporation, working in a job, or being a corporate executive. I don't think there's anything about those things that would make it impossible for a Christian to do it. I'm not even necessarily talking about the political world. I'm not necessarily saying it's wrong for Christians to get involved in some measure in politics. I'm not sure that it's right, I must confess, but I'm not sure that it's wrong either. I don't know that the Bible speaks directly to the subject. It depends on what kind of involvement a person has and what their activities involve. I think there certainly are political offices that Christians have no business being in. And there are certain jobs they have no business being in, too. But I'm not suggesting that Christians should all go out and live in the woods and, live off of nuts and berries and stuff and not have jobs and not have homes and avoid all society. That's not what I'm suggesting. We're talking about something more spiritual here. The world's values and the world's system, the world's culture, the world's ambitions, the world's tastes, and so forth, are often very corrupt and not consistent with what Christians are supposed to be standing for, what Christ stands for. And I think we need to always be examining ourselves to see how much of what we've brought with us into our Christian lives. I seek to do this all the time, even though I've been a Christian many years. How much of the attitudes I was raised with and what I brought with me into the Christian life, how much of that still is worldly and not really sanctified, not really Christ-like, not really communicating to people what I think Jesus would have communicated. We all need to do that. I think Jonathan taking probably what he considered to be a loyal stand for Christ or for David in the kingdom had to do so by by making the choice to go back to his father's kingdom. He was, by being there, endorsing Saul's kingdom and its legitimacy. Every day that Jonathan lived in the house, it was a denial that David was the true king. If Jonathan had said, listen, my dad may be recognized as king and me as his son may be recognized as prince, but I don't recognize that. I recognize David as God's anointed, and I don't belong in this path. David does, and if he can't be here, I won't be here either. To my mind, that would have been the right thing. David does not seem to hold it against Jonathan that Jonathan made this decision, but it must have been, I don't know for sure, it seems to me like it would have been a bit disappointing to David to have to run off alone, and his best friend stays behind with his enemies. Well, chapter 21. Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? He was accustomed to David leading armies, not running alone. and by the way, David, I don't know what he was wearing, but remember, he just slipped out of his bedroom. He didn't have his sword. He didn't have armor. He didn't have anything. In fact, he probably hadn't slept in bed for a couple nights because of this test that was being run on how Saul would react. So he's unkempt and smelly and so forth, and probably his clothes are dirty. He's been sleeping out in the field. He doesn't look like a royal or military leader on assignment. And so the priest says, "Hey, why are you alone? No one's with you." David said to Ahimelech, the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business in which I send you, or what I have commanded you. And I have directed my young men to such and such a place.'" In other words, I've told them I'll meet them someplace. I'm going to utmost secrecy mission, so I've had them, we got a rendezvous plan. Well, this, of course, was a lie. And not only didn't resemble the truth at all, it was absolutely contrary to the truth. Now, David, I suspect, as I think I mentioned earlier in our last session, probably lied to the priest on this occasion for two reasons. One, he might not be sure whether the priest would be on his side. If there was a known conflict and there was a price on David's head, the priest may not be willing to take sides with David in such a situation. He may be sure of the priest's loyalty to him in a case like this. So he could not disclose that he was being persecuted by Saul. But another reason might have been that even if he was sure Ahimelech would have taken his side in the matter, if Ahimelech knowingly did so, that would set Ahimelech up for the accusation that he's co-conspirator with David against Saul, as, of course, Saul eventually accused the priest of anyway, even falsely. So by telling Ahimelech a false story, Ahimelech could truthfully say, "Well, I didn't know. You know, I didn't sponsor any kind of rebellion against Saul. I had the impression David was a good guy and that he was on Saul's errand." So whatever David's reasons, by the way, he probably partly wanted to protect himself and partly wanted to protect the priest. If the priest was a bad guy, a lie would protect David. If the priest was a good guy, the lie would protect the priest. But the lie ended up not protecting the priest at all, as we find out. David miscalculated here. "Now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand and whatever can be found." And the priest answered David and said, "There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women." Now, what young men? Now, he said he had directed his young men, in verse 2, to meet him in such a place. And perhaps the priest means the young men that you're going to meet with. And, you know, I suspect the priest was not taken in by this ruse. I mean, this could not have been a very convincing lie that David's telling. Here, he's not in uniform. He has no weapon. He's going to war on secret errand, but he forgot his weapon. Forgot his uniform. Forgot to comb his hair. I mean, he's all alone. No other men have been seen, but he says they're somewhere and he's going to meet them. And he can't say a word about what his mission is. I mean, and it can hardly have escaped the public notice that Saul had been hurling javelins at David. I mean, how could that not be whispered or even gossiped freely around the country? I mean, the king's doing crazy things. Everyone in the country knew, of course, and the high priest would be among those that would be most privy to information of this kind, I would think, that the king was jealous of David and had tried to kill him. And here, this is a very suspicious-looking situation. And the idea that David was fleeing from Saul would be much more evident just at the face of it than anything David would be suggesting falsely about it. And so I suspect the priest knew that David was lying to him. But he played along with it. You know, David said, I've told my young men to meet me in such and such places. Yeah, okay, if the young men, wink, you know, have kept themselves pure, we can get some food. It really, were there any men with David? That's a good question. We do not read of any young men being with David on this occasion. And the priest indicates that there's no one with him. However, no one with you might just mean your army's not with you. There might have been 1 or 2 attendants with him. I don't know. Maybe some of David's friends were accompanying him out of the country. Now, there's nothing in this passage that suggests that anyone was with David. But Jesus suggested that someone was with David on this occasion. In fact, Jesus, if we could turn to Mark chapter 2. There's a couple of slight problems in comparing this story with this passage in Mark. Mark chapter 2 and verse 26, or 25 and 26, Jesus said, "But he said to them, 'Have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry, and he and those with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and also gave some to those who were with him?'"
Well, unless David went and ate showbread twice, and only one time is recorded in Scripture, Jesus must be referring to the passage we're reading here. A couple of problems are involved. One is that it mentions here the men who are with him. However, that can be resolved, I think, by suggesting that it was fine after David takes this showbread that he actually does join with about 400 men. There may have even been a few of them with him on this occasion. Not enough, like he was on a real errand, a military errand. Still, it was as if no one was with him. There might have been a few with him. Or he might have been all alone, but shortly afterwards met up with 400 men and shared the bread with them. We don't know. If, in fact, the men were not with him when he took the bread, but helped him eat it later that day or the next day, that would agree with the wording that Jesus gave, that you know those who were with David ate the showbread. They weren't with him when he was at the tabernacle at Nob, but they were with him perhaps that day or the next day when he still had some bread to share. That would solve the problem, or another way to solve it would be to say that David did have a few companions with him, some friends accompanying him to make sure he made it safely to the border or whatever. We simply don't know. We don't have the information in the Old Testament in detail enough to know how Jesus' words are to be understood there. Frankly, a slightly bigger problem in Jesus' statement is in verse 26 when he says, in the days of Abiathar, the high priest. When David came and ate the showbread in the days of Abiathar, the high priest. Well, the text we're reading says that Ahimelech was the high priest. Abiathar actually was his son who escaped from the slaughter when Doeg killed all the priests. Abiathar was the only surviving son of Ahimelech and ran to David and survived and became high priest afterwards. But when David came to Nob and ate the showbread, Ahimelech was the high priest. And yet Jesus says it was in the days of Abiathar, the high priest. Now, there's a number of ways to reconcile this apparent problem. Of course, many people would just say that Jesus had a memory lapse. Jesus forgot who was the high priest and gave the wrong name. This does not square well, though, with the suggestion that Jesus spoke everything he spoke directly from the Father. The words he spoke were his own, but were the Father's who spoke through him, and that he spoke infallibly there. So those who would suggest that Jesus made a mistake on this occasion, I think, have to make some serious compromises in their opinion of Jesus generally. I don't think that is a necessary way to resolve this. We can resolve it other ways. One way that one scholar thought to reconcile it was to say that Abiathar, although he was not the high priest, the principal high priest, his father Ahimelech was, yet on that particular day, Abiathar was serving in the temple with his father, perhaps even apprenticing as the high priest heir or whatever. We know that in the days of Jesus there were two high priests. There was Annas and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, who were both priests at the same time. This, however, is not necessarily a situation that prevailed at an earlier date, and we don't have any real reason to believe that Abiathar was called the high priest or was a junior high priest or was an apprentice high priest at this time, and that suggestion doesn't strike me as the most likely solution. What I consider to be the most likely solution is that Jesus, he doesn't say that Abiathar was the high priest. He says it was in the days of Abiathar, the high priest. Now, Abiathar did become high priest. And if I would talk about the childhood of President Washington, if I said President George Washington when he was a child, cut down a cherry tree, I just called him President Washington, though he was by no means president as a child. He became a president later. But because he later did become president, was President Washington, or we could talk about President Lincoln in the days when he was growing up and so forth, we call him president because that's his title. That was what he became. He will forever be remembered as. Abiathar later became high priest after these days, actually in the days of David, he did. And therefore, Jesus and all others who lived after him would remember him as Abiathar, the high priest. Now, did David come and eat the showbread in the days of Abiathar? He did. In fact, Abiathar had to flee for his life because Abiathar was there. It was in his days that Jesus did it. He was not yet high priest, but that he might speak, we call it proleptically, of Abiathar's, Abiathar the high priest. Does not mean he was the high priest at the time that the event took place, but he is a man who later became high priest and forever afterward would be called high priest Abiathar. Doesn't mean that he necessarily had to be high priest at the moment that the story relates to. This may not satisfy everyone, but my consideration of that is that that's probably a worthy solution and the correct solution. Okay, and if you want to keep searching for other solutions, if that doesn't satisfy you, feel free to do so. Yes, Sam?
Is there anything to believe that Jesus
Yeah, perhaps because Abiathar actually defected and went with David and was the loyal priest who suffered with David, whereas Ahimelech didn't go with David. Of course, he didn't know the danger. At least he wasn't told directly of it. But Ahimelech did not specifically side with David. You know, he did help David, but on the pretext that David was a loyal citizen of Saul's. It may be that Ahimelech was a man of less virtue or less loyalty to David than Abiathar was later on. Now, later on, Abiathar defected over to Adonijah, and one of David's sons, when David had chosen Solomon. And that cost Abiathar the priesthood, and he was replaced by Zadok. But Abiathar was the loyal priest under David virtually for his whole life. And perhaps that is why he's remembered more than Ahimelech and honored him. That is a good question, and it's been a slight problem that has perplexed people a long time. To my mind, it's not a problem that lacks adequate solution, but it's a problem that needs to be solved, and can be, I think. Now, the showbread, as it was called, here the priest calls it holy bread in verse 4. This was the 12 loaves that were set out once a week on the Sabbath in the tabernacle on the table of showbread, and they were left there for a week, and after they were a week old, the priest ate them and replaced them with fresh loaves. And this must have been a Sabbath, it would appear, because the loaves were replaced and given to David. What's amazing is that the priest had no other bread besides the show bread. In more religious times in Israel's history, their priest should have an abundance of food, because all the tithes of the people, of their grain and of their wine and of their fruits and of their meat, was brought to the priests, and the priests, it was available to them. Now, this food would have been available, but the priest says, we don't have any food here except the showbread. It means that, you know, the religion of Israel had fallen on very hard times. There were not many people paying their tithes. The people were getting by. There was no food around except for this. And that would agree generally, I think, with the whole picture of the period that we have from the days of Eli and even before and the judges, that the service of God in the tabernacle was somewhat marginalized and not many people were involved in it. And the tithes, apparently, would have been hard to be a priest in those days, you know, when you live entirely on people's tithes and the people are all backslidden. Anyway, David answered the priest and said to him, truly women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. Now, David had been away from his wife for 3 days because he'd had to wait 2 days for the message to come back from Jonathan. So that was true of him. Whether there were any other men with him or not, and whether this applied to them, we don't know for sure. David was not, strictly speaking, telling the truth all through this story, so he may have even lied on behalf of his men. But I'd just as soon suggest that he wasn't lying. It's possible that when he fled from his own home, that some of his servants or loyal friends fled with him, and we just haven't read about it, and that they all spent time waiting for Jonathan to bring back word of what happened in the palace, and that they've all been together for 3 days. This is possible. We just don't know. We can't say for sure. But he says, the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was sanctified in the vessel this day. Now, the meaning of this is very confusing, even though it was sanctified in the vessel this day. Many different interpretations of this have been offered. I don't know that we need to really settle on one. The one point in this verse I'd like to put is that he says the vessels of the young men are holy. Now, the vessels of the young men could be, you know, their knapsacks or whatever they carry things in. However, there's no reason to believe that their vessels would be holy. This would technically refer to implements, furniture, and silverware, and pots and pans of the temple. Whatever was in the temple or the tabernacle would be holy. But just, you know, your knapsack or your lunchbox, whatever, that wouldn't be holy. Even if you'd avoid ceremonial defilement of it, it still wasn't a holy item like the things in the tabernacle were. So it's not clear what he means that their vessels are holy. However, I'm of the opinion he's using a figure of speech which Paul also uses. If you'll check over at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, this statement from David, in fact, helped us to understand the meaning of 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 4. But we'll give context, which would be verses 3 through 5. 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 3 through 5. For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification, that means holiness, and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. Now, Paul is clearly arguing for sexual purity here. And he refers to possessing your vessel with honor. Now, some of the rabbis in their writings referred to a man's wife as his vessel, and for that reason, some translations, I don't approve of this, but some translations like the RSV have translated this, how you should, each man should have a wife, should obtain a wife in sanctification and honor. In other words, they just interpret the word vessel to mean a wife, because some rabbis use the word vessel to refer to wives. However, the question is, did Paul use it that way? Or did anyone biblically use it that way? I don't think so. I'm not aware of any New Testament or Old Testament writer that spoke of a man's wife as a vessel. The rabbis might have done so, but I don't think that's a biblical thing. But in 2 Corinthians, chapter 4, verse 7, 2 Corinthians 4, 7, Paul said, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels." Now, he's referring to the treasure of the glory of God that resides in us. But the earthen vessel is our bodies. Our bodies are made of earth. They're made of dust. And therefore, they are containers of this treasure. The earthen vessels in Paul's is a reference to our bodies. And therefore, it is most likely when Paul is talking about sexual purity, he says that men should learn how to possess their vessels in sanctification and honor. They need to keep their bodies pure and holy. Vessel referring to your body. Now, what's interesting here is the idea of keeping your vessel holy or possessing your vessel in sanctification. And Paul uses an area in the context of sexual abstinence would seem to fit here too. David is answering that they've been kept from women for 3 days and their vessels are holy. Now, it should be made plain that sexual relations between a man and wife does not render a man unholy. It says that in Hebrews chapter 15 that marriage is honorable among all and the bed is undefiling and undefiled. Marriage bed is not a defiling or unholy thing. David was married, but perhaps some of the men that he was with were not. And in those days of loose religion and loose morals and concubinage and all that kind of stuff, even prostitution, it's not unthinkable that some of the soldiers or some of the companions of David might, on some occasions, at least be suspected to have been loose in their morals, and he'd have to affirm, well, they haven't touched any women. Their vessels are holy. Suggesting not so much that they haven't slept with their wives, which may have been true as well, but that they have not defiled their bodies with sexual immorality. I suspect that to be the meaning, and I think that Paul picks up the very language in 1 Thessalonians to address the single men remaining celibate. Verse 6, "So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the show bread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul." This man was apparently not a high-ranking official, but he did oversee the shepherds that took care of the royal herds. "And David said to Ahimelech, the priest, 'Is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor weapons with me, because the king's business required haste.'" Yeah, sure. The guy's on an important mission. He forgets to bring his sword. And he's a military leader. "Just forgot my weapons." "So the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it. For there is no other except that one here.' And David said, 'There is none like it. Give it to me.'" The sword must have been extremely heavy and presumably fairly unwieldy to carry around for an average-sized man or even a normal-sized man. Goliath probably having a sword proportionate in length to what his size would dictate. Although, in many cases, swords were not particularly long. I mean, the Romans, for example, did most of their fighting with a short, broad sword. I don't know what the Philistines used. It may be that Goliath had a larger-than-average sword. It may not have been longer than an average-sized man could carry with him. And to picture David dragging along this, you know, 7-foot-long sword or something as he's running through the woods is kind of hard to picture, but it may not have been so enormous or so long. Anyway, we don't know why the sword was laid up there at the tabernacle behind the ephod wrapped in a cloth, but probably it was left there as a reminder of God's victory, just there as an emblem to remember that God had saved his people before. But as the tabernacle had been forgotten, probably the sword and David's victory over Goliath had been forgotten. And David, of course, had a right to that sword. He had acquired it through battle. So he took it. Now he had a weapon. Now, Jonathan had earlier given David his sword. But in fact, David had escaped without his sword. He had left in haste. And that seems rather strange, but maybe climbing out a wall. Maybe the people were actually at the door when he had to leave his house out the window. Hard to say. In which case, he couldn't even run across the room to grab his sword. Maybe his weaponry was kept at an armory somewhere not at home, and he didn't have the liberty to go and get it. But for some reason, he didn't have the sword that he normally possessed, so he got Goliath's sword. Whether he ever used Goliath's sword, we never read. He armed himself, but as far as we know, to be put to battle man-to-man in a sword fight after this point. "Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul, and went to Achish, the king of Gath." That's a strange place to go. Gath is the city Goliath had come from. Now, David was really pressing his luck here, because he figured Gath is the city of the Philistines. It was going to be, you know, they'd be enemies of Saul. Well, David could convincingly represent himself as an enemy of Saul. although he really had no evil designs or hostility towards Saul, it was clear that Saul did toward him. And news of that may well reach the Philistines through their spy network or whatever. And so he could convincingly present himself as one wishing to act to the Philistines. Now, that is taking a big gamble, because although he might have a convincing claim he could have a motive for defecting the Philistines, yet they still might hold something against him for killing their champion. That was hitting, after all. And it lost the Philistines more than their champion. It lost them their freedom and got them plundered. And you would think the inhabitants of Gath might well have a real grudge against David. Well, he took his chances. He felt like the safest place where Saul could no way pursue him would be in this Philistine city. And he thought he'd see whether this would work as a refuge. As it turned out, it didn't, for reasons that we will find. And the servants Achish, which was the king of that city, said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David's 10,000s? And those thousands were Philistines, and those 10,000s were Philistines. And that's us. You know, this is the guy they celebrated, that he killed 10,000 of us, and we're letting him hear." Now David took these words to heart, and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath, so he changed his behavior before them, feigned madness in their hands, scratched on the doors, or scribbled, actually a slight change of the vowel points in the Hebrew could say banged on the doors, beat on the doors. We don't know exactly what he was doing on the doors there. Of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. Notice he drooled. He allowed himself to drool. He put on a very convincing act, by the way. Then Achish said to his servants, "Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me?" Yeah. His beard, we know that. "Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" And we read in the next chapter, "Therefore David departed from there." He obviously realized that it was not a safe place. The servants of Achish were too suspicious. The only way he could be safe among them was to feign madness, and he didn't want to do that for the rest of his life. Might as well go somewhere else. And so he did that. Now, apparently, his situation there in Gath at this time was worse than this story even indicates, because one of the Psalms, Psalm 56, was written at this time and mentions that he was actually arrested there. Psalm 56. Now, that's not the right Psalm, is it? But it was. Is it 57? Oh, yes, it is. I'm looking at the wrong book, not the wrong chapter. Okay, yeah, the psalm title at Psalm 56 says, "To the chief musician set to the silent dove in distant lands," a known tune. What if I know Christians have picked up on these types and written music then? "A Mishnah of David when the Philistines captured him in Gath." It is generally understood that this was when he went there on this occasion, and the Philistines, the servants of Achish, they not only reported him to Achish, they captured him and brought him. Apparently incarcerated him while something could be decided about him, and that's when he decided the smartest thing to do would be to act like a bad man, and they'd just let him go. And we won't read that psalm simply because we're low on time, but it's got some great verses in it. It starts, "Be merciful to me, O God, for man would swallow me up. Fighting all day, he oppresses me." This may refer to Saul, or it may refer to the Philistines, who we are told here had captured him. "My enemies would hound me all day, for there are many who fight against me," O Most High. He must have felt like he really didn't have any friends at that time, when the king of his own land and the king of his enemies were both persecuting him. "Whenever I'm afraid, I will trust in you. In God, I will praise his word. In God, I have put my trust. I will not fear. What can flesh do to me?" That's a great confidence that he has there in his situation. Anyway, we will not read that whole psalm. Let's find some. He wrote that at this time. We need to move along, however, through 1 Samuel. Psalm 34 was also written about that time. Well, during his flight, anyway. Was it written while he was in Gath? I have it. Okay, there you go. Thank you. Yeah, Psalm 34 also, when he printed madness before Abimelech, who drove and he departed. Now, there's a bit of a problem, because it says before Abimelech. However, the king in 1 Samuel chapter 21 of Gath is Achish. But this is not a serious problem, because Abimelech was a title, like Pharaoh in Egypt. Abimelech means "my father the king." That's the meaning of the word. And apparently the Philistines referred to all of their kings as Abimelech, just like the Egyptians referred to all of their kings as Pharaoh. They had their own personal names as well, but they had the title, Abimelech. So when it says in Psalm 34's title, "He feigned madness before Abimelech," this would be the man's title, not his personal name. The man's personal name, as we see, was Achish. All right, so David finds no rest there among the Philistines. Chapter 22. "David therefore departed from there and escaped the cave of Adullam." Now, Adullam was only a couple of hours' walk from his home in Bethlehem. It was out in the wilderness. And it says, "And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him." Now, not all of his brothers were all that friendly with him. But why did they go down there to him on this occasion? Did they just go up there and say goodbye, or did they join him? I bet they must have joined him for a while, because he later we find he takes them to Moab and leaves them there for safekeeping. Why would he have to do this? Well, obviously, if you think for a moment about it, the answer is obvious. Saul, if he was unable to catch David, all he'd have to do is go to Bethlehem and take David's father and say, okay, let this out, David. Unless you come and turn yourself in, I can kill your father or your brothers. I mean, anyone that was known to be related or close to David would be vulnerable. If Saul got frustrated pursuing David, he could easily get David to turn himself in by, you know, taking a hostage from David's family. And it's obvious that David would come in to rescue them. So in order to deprive Saul of that opportunity, he apparently sent messengers to his family in Bethlehem, had them come out and meet him, and they apparently became refugees also, and in Moab eventually. First they meet him at Dullam. And everyone who is in distress, verse 2 says, everyone who is in debt, and everyone who is discontent gathered to him, so he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. Now this was not a static number, it kept growing. We later will read, the number in the next chapter is 600 men with him. Actually, is it the next chapter or a little further down? In chapter 23, verse 13, it mentions 600 men with him. Later on still, the books of Chronicles tell us of other men defecting to David at other points in his career of flight from Saul. Apparently, there was a growing and justified discontent on the part of many Israelites with Saul's leadership, and that'd be obvious. The man was public mad and persecuting a national hero for no reason. I mean, obviously, the only people who had remained loyal to Saul were the wimps who didn't have any backbone and were just afraid to stand up for what's right. The champions, even probably some of the most military prestigious people, chose to go with David. After all, remember, he had been the commander over 1,000 men. I would imagine those closest to him in the high ranks below him probably had come to be come to admire him a great deal, and probably many of them were among those that defected. And it was a growing number. And as it turns out, some of the ones that later defect, according to the books of Chronicles, which we'll read at the proper place, were men of war, mighty men of valor who defected from Saul's army to come over to David. So he starts out with maybe a handful of guys, I don't know how many, but then there's 400, then there's 600, then the number, we lose track of the numbers, but it's a growing company. He's got a growing army there. Now, they don't ever fight any actual wars against Saul, which is interesting. Saul brings his armies against them, but all they do is run away. Eventually, they do fight wars against other enemies under David's leadership, but they are not gathering in order to fight their own countrymen under Saul. They are gathering because they believe in David and they want to be on the right side when God settles the score. Now, it's interesting the description of those who sided with David during his time of unpopular persecution. They were people in distress, people who had debts, and people who were discontented with the current situation. Those who will make sacrifices to follow Jesus today are often not the ones who are comfortable and rich and have everything in the world going for them. The people that followed Jesus are not the ones who are the most comfortable in this world. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1, consider your calling, brethren. There's not many wise, not many noble, not many great men among you. God has chosen the poor, the foolish, the weak. And part of this is because, obviously, those who fit the latter description are not contented in the world. If a person's content with the world, they're going to be less likely to be wanting to throw everything over and risk their lives for an unpopular cause. But if people are already saying, boy, I'm glad to have an alternative to Saul. I don't care what it costs me. I'm getting out of this guy's domain. I'm going to follow David. Some of them, you know, were defaulting on debts, it looks like. However, spiritually speaking, if we make this a type, we could see that as those of us who have unpaid debts also are the ones who come to Christ. We recognize our indebtedness. We recognize we have debt we can't pay. And the only way we get ourselves out of debt to God, as it were, is to have him forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And that forgiveness comes through our being attached to Christ. Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me. So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all that time that David was in the stronghold. That is the natural stronghold of the caves and stuff that he lived in for a while. Then the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah. So David departed and went to the forest of Herith. Now, it's not all that clear what motivated David some of the things he did. Now, taking his family and leaving them at Moab made good sense. First of all, Moab was a foreign country. Saul could not intrude there to capture them without going to war with the Moabites, which he would probably not find to be desirable on the mere supposition that it might get him command of David's father or brothers, who were less the target than David himself. And David's father had Moabite ancestry. David's father was the grandson of Ruth, who was a Moabitess, and therefore David could appeal to the king of Moab on the basis of, you know, we got some blood ties here. Could I, you know, and we're not at war at the moment. The Moabites sometimes were at war with Israel, but they weren't at this time. Could I leave my parents, my family here? To take his family with him, especially if his mother and his father and so forth were old, would be a detriment to him. And it's possible his brothers may have gone with him if they were supportive of him. If they were still not supportive of him, they may have just stayed in Moab to save their own skins. At a later time, David actually goes and makes war against Moab in his career, and some have suggested it may be the reason because the Moabites might have mistreated his family. We don't know that they did, but it seems strange that he'd receive a favor from Moab, a protection for his family on this occasion, and later in his career go out and wipe them out, the Moabites. It's possible that his family did not receive very hospitable treatment on this occasion. Now, the prophet Gad is just mentioned here. We find that Gad and Nathan are prophets that tend to rise up to counsel David in his life after Samuel is no longer with him. Samuel, for one thing, dies, probably while David is still in flight. And even before he died, he was old. He probably was not very mobile. He couldn't travel with him. So younger prophets come along to give David instruction where Samuel had previously been available to do. Gad and Nathan become the principal prophets in David's life. And by the way, the stories of David are almost certainly originally preserved by Samuel, Gad, and Nathan, because we later read of them as sources of information about the history of David. In I think it's in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. 1 Chronicles 29:29 says, "Now the acts of King David, first and last, indeed they are written in the book of Samuel the seer, in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the book of Gad the seer." These three prophets whose lifetimes overlap that of David at various times knew David, counseled David, and eventually wrote books about David. And it's no doubt their books which became the sources of information that someone later put together into what we now have as the books of Samuel. So we have Gad with him here. Now he says, "Don't stay in the stronghold." It's not clear exactly why he should not stay in the stronghold, but he was to depart to Judah. Perhaps because David was of the tribe of Judah, he found more sympathy among the people of his own tribe. For him to be in the realm of Judah, even though the kingdom had not divided between Judah and Israel yet, as it later did, yet to have his own tribesmen nearby, that he might receive more hospitality. After all, he and his men are going to have to eat something. They can't hunt much out there in the wilderness. They can't grow food, and it wouldn't be very good for them to steal it. So they're going to have to live off of donations from friendly people. And no doubt the reason that the Lord told him through the prophet to go down and stay in the land of Judah is that he would find more sympathetic support down there, although that support would have to be more or less clandestine and secretive, because no one could really support him publicly do so without risking being killed by Saul. So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth, which is in Judah. Then Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah, with his spear in his hand and all his servants standing about him. Then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites." Now remember, Saul was a Benjamite, and apparently he practiced a bit of nepotism in appointing his officers. He often appointed people of his own tribe, Benjamin. He said, "Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" And I'm a Benjamite like you folks are. David is not. He's king. He's going to give you these positions I've given you. He'll likely appoint people of his own tribe, the tribe of Judah. And what he's saying is, if you like having these high positions, these high-ranking positions, you better support my kingship, because if I lose it, David's coming to power. Do you think he's going to elevate you for no better reason than that you're of the tribe of Benjamin? David's not likely to favor the tribe of Benjamin, because he's not of that tribe. So he says, "All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is no one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Now, my servant, I think, is a reference to David. And he's saying, Jonathan and David have conspired together against me, and David is lying in wait to destroy me. Now, this is nothing but paranoia on the part of Saul. There's no such plot on David's mind. But Saul, of course, cannot persecute David without some pretext. I mean, he's got the whole armies of Israel, thousands of men, following David, and he's got to have some pretext. I mean, they got to ask, by the way, Saul, why are we after this guy? What has he done wrong? Well, he's trying to kill me. He wants to kill me and take my throne. He had to come up with something that sounded like treason or a capital offense for which he could justify killing David, though it was, of course, a fabrication. And we see that this is his fabrication. David later pulls the covers and shows how foolish that is, even in front of the armies. When David encounters Saul in a cave and doesn't kill him, and then comes out and waves a part of Saul's garment in front of all the armies that are with Saul and say, look, Saul, I could have killed you. I didn't want to. Don't believe lying people who tell you I'm trying to kill you. And the armies then at least knew that Saul was wrong. Anyway, at this point, Saul's trying to convince people that David wants to kill him, but possibly no one believes him. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse going down to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, priests who were in Nob. And they all came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, son of Ahitub. And he answered, here am I, my lord. And Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me and lie in wait as it is this day? So Ahimelech answered the king and said, and who among all your servants is so faithful as David, who is the king's son and goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? In other words, is that the first time I ever inquired of God for him? Apparently David went to Nob initially to inquire of the Lord with the Urim and the Thummim. And Saul says, why did you inquire of God for David? And the priest says, what, is this the first time I've done this? In other words, it's rather customary, is it not, for David to inquire of the Lord when he's going on a mission? You know, what's so different about this case? Now, the priest was either ignorant or professing to be ignorant. He could have been, you know, just in a role of innocence, and he may have been as innocent as he claims to be. We don't know. It says, did I then begin to inquire of the Lord for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much. And the king said, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell me. But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. By the way, nor did Saul have the right to do so. In a theocracy, the king is actually subject to the priests and to the prophets, not vice versa. But remember, the people asked that they could have a king like all the nations had. In other nations that are not theocracies, the king is above the priests. And Saul was definitely a king like all nations had, a tyrant. And he did not acknowledge that God's priests were actually superior to him in rank. So he ordered people to execute him. Actually, the soldiers still had a conscience. They were not crazy like Saul, and therefore they wouldn't strike the priests. And the king said to Doeg, you turn and kill the priests. So Doeg, the king, turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. We have to assume the priests were unarmed and, of course, made no attempt to defend themselves. How could the army was there, and on the command of the king they were to be executed? So these innocent priests, 85 of them, were slain, just adding to Saul's many crimes. Also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep, with the edge of the sword. Now, of course, Saul had been commanded to do that very thing to the Amalekites earlier and had failed to obey the command. But now, in rebellion against God and against God's purposes, he carries out what's called the ban on a city. In the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 13:15 said that this kind of treatment should be executed on a city if idolatry was found to be there. According to Deuteronomy 13 and verse 15, if idolatry was practiced in the city, that all the nations should rise up against the city and treat it just like this, kill every last man, woman, child, and animal in it, and burn it to the ground, leave nothing of that city. Well, Saul treats the city that had, as he conspired on David's side, under the ban, as if it had been guilty of idolatry. And so he not only kills the priests, many of whom had nothing to, no, probably not even any contact with David when he came there that time, but their wives, their children, their babies, and everything, he just slaughters them all. Also Nob, we read that, verse 20. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. Now, it's hard to know whether he did so during the slaughter. And if so, how he escaped. It would appear that if he escaped, he's the only one who did, and he would have the advantage over the other 85 priests, and that he'd be able to escape, others wouldn't, is not explained. It may be that he saw this coming. It may be that he had been with his father when David came, and he knew what would come of it, and more on the ball, and maybe appear at the summons before Saul, and he fled instead, knowing what was coming. I don't know. Somehow he escaped where no others did. That also happened to one of the sons of Gideon when one of his sons, Abimelech, actually slaughtered all the sons of Gideon, what, 70 of them, but one of them escaped. How one gets away and the other 69 don't is not clear. But he obviously had an advantage over the others, and he escaped and fled after David. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. So David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, 'I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe.'" David actually wrote Psalm 52 offering this news. Psalm 52 is written against Doeg, who killed the priest. And it says in the Psalm title, at Psalm 52, it says, to the chief musician, a contemplation of David when Doeg the Edomite went and told Saul and said to him, "David has gone to the house of Ahimelech." Now, David learned of this only after the slaughter. He didn't learn of it before the slaughter. So David wrote this psalm having heard about the slaughter of the priest. And he says, "Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man?" Obviously referring to Doeg. "The goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, and lying rather than speaking righteousness. You love all devouring words, you deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place and uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, 'Here is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of riches, and strengthened himself in his wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise you forever because you have done it, and in the presence of your saints I will wait on your name, for it is good.'" So David's just contemplating, as it says. It's a contemplation of David. The contrast between those who are motivated by evil to seek advancement and power and make themselves strong through evil and wickedness, and his own situation where he refused to compromise his integrity, and he's just trusting in God to cause him to blossom like a tree in the proper time. Doeg obviously reported on the priest with hope of gaining some advancement in Saul's administration, and no doubt he received that. Chapter 23. Then they told David, saying, by the way, we don't read any more of Doeg. We don't know how he was punished, but I'm sure that he came to it all end. After all, David prophesied it in Psalm 52 that he would. Then they told David, saying, "Look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah," a Jewish city, "and they are robbing the threshing floors. Therefore David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go and attack these Philistines?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah.'" Now he inquired through the Urim and the Thummim, because we read in verse 6 that the ephod was there with him, and the ephod contained the breastplate of the priest with the Urim and Thummim in it, and they used that for discerning the will of God. So God actually sent him on this mission. By the way, it should be pointed out that David fought wars as God told him to fight wars, and he did not fight them when God told him not to, generally speaking. Even though he was a man of war, and there were many warlike things his enemies did, he didn't always fight them. He did so when the Lord said to, and not other times, which means that war is not something that is always right, even if there's provocation from an enemy. Knowing the will of God is a little more complicated than just to know that there's an enemy who wants to fight you. And David's men said to him, "Look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more than if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" In other words, we're in our own home country, and we're not very secure here. We're going to go into the thick of danger and fight Philistines as well and deliver this city that's, we don't owe them anything. And David inquired of the Lord once again, and the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into your hand." And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, struck them with a mighty blow, and took away their livestock, which David and his men could use. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. Now it happened when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah that he went down with an ephod in his hand. And Saul was told that David had gone to Keilah. So Saul said, "God has delivered him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars." Apparently after delivering Keilah, David and his men found some refreshment indoors in this walled city for a while. They figured, well, hey, these people owe us a little hospitality. You know, we've been living out in the woods. Here we can at least take a bath. So Saul heard that David was in there. Hey, he's locked in. So it says, Then Saul called all the people together for war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. When David knew that Saul plotted evil against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." And David said, "O Lord God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down." Then David said, "Will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will deliver you." So David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah and went wherever they could go. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted the expedition. What's interesting about this story is that Saul didn't come down and the people didn't turn David over because David left. But God prophesied Saul will come down and the men will deliver you over. But it's obvious that that's a contingent prophecy, just like when Jonah said in 40 days Nineveh is going to perish. That didn't happen either. But that's because it was contingent on a condition being met. And that was when the people repented, God didn't bring the disaster he said. David is saying, essentially, God in the city, will Saul come down and will they deliver me? And God says, yep, sure will. So David leaves and the thing predicted doesn't happen. So it shows that not only does God know what will happen, he knows what would happen if circumstances are a certain way. If David stayed there, he knew what Saul would do and what the people would do. Of course, David didn't stay there, and so none of those things happened that were predicted. But that was the predictions were contingent on whether David would stay there or not, obviously. And David stayed in strongholds in the wilderness and remained in the mountains, in the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. How many days or months this went on, we don't know. It's just summarizing. So David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in the forest. Then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. To strengthen a man's hands is a Hebraism that means to encourage someone, to strengthen their hands. To weaken their hands is to discourage them. Commonly in the Old Testament, it's just a Hebraism, an idiomatic expression. So Jonathan encouraged David in the Lord. Now, how did Jonathan find him? Apparently, David must have sent occasional secret messages back to Jonathan to apprise him of where he was and where he could be found, trusting Jonathan's total loyalty to him. And Jonathan said to David in verse 17, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed in the woods, and Jonathan went to his own house. So apparently Jonathan wanted to be next to David in the kingdom, but not next to him in the woods. Then the Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is David not hiding with us in the strongholds in the woods, in the hill of Hakilah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now therefore, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul, come down, and on our part we shall deliver him into the king's hand." And Saul said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, for you have compassion on me. Please go and find out for sure and see the place where his hideout is and who has seen him there, for I am told that he is very crafty. See, therefore, and take knowledge of all the lurking places where he hides and come back to me with certainty, and I will go with you, and it shall be, if he is in the land, that I will search for him throughout all the clans of Judah." Now, it's interesting how many people were willing to deliver David over to Saul. The people of Keilah, whom David and his men had saved their necks from an invasion of the Philistines, they would have turned him over to Saul. The Ziphites, who against whom David has done nothing, and who could well be grateful to him for delivering them from the Philistines when he killed Goliath and on other occasions when he delivered the nation, they too want to turn him over to Saul. It seems clear that people were more willing to seek the favor of the king, the man who had political and carnal and military power, than the favor of God. There's no gratitude for the things David has done for them. There's no fear of God. They just want to do the treacherous thing because they know that'll make the king happy with them, and they don't want to incur the king's wrath. Wimps. Verse 24. So they arose and went to Ziph before Saul, but David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in a plain on the south of Jeshimon. When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David. Therefore he went down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. Then Saul went on the one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. So David made haste to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were encircling David and his men to take them. Apparently it came very, very close. On one mountain,
David and his men were on one side, and Saul was pursuing even on the same mountain that near. But a messenger, by the way, well, we'll read the finish, then I'll make my point. But a messenger came to Saul, saying, "Hasten and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land." Therefore, Saul returned from pursuing David, probably not knowing how close he was. He probably never had David in his sights, but the narrative tells us that he actually was very close to him. But not knowing how close he was to capturing David, he turned back because of an invasion of the Philistines, which he had to attend to. He returned from pursuing David and went against the Philistines, so they called the place the Rock of Escaping. And David went up from there and dwelt in the strongholds of En-Gedi. Now, Psalm 54 was written at this time, when David was being pursued on this occasion, when the people of Ziph had called Saul in there. And if you'll notice what David says in Psalm 54, as with so many of his psalms, he starts this way: "Save me, O God, by your name. Vindicate me by your strength. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers have risen up against me, and oppressors have sought after my life. They have not set God before them." Notice the psalm title says, "A contemplation of David when the Ziphites went and said to Saul, 'Is David not hiding with us?' Behold, God is my helper. The Lord is with those who uphold my life. He will repay my enemies for their evil. Cut them off in your truth. I will freely sacrifice to you. I will praise your name, O Lord, for it is good. For he has delivered me out of all trouble, and my eye has seen its desire upon my enemies." A short psalm of confidence, calling out on God for help, complaining about the treachery of those who are against him, and stating his confidence that God will save him. Sure enough, God did. God answered this prayer and, of course, sent the Philistines against Israel to get Saul's attention elsewhere. And Saul was very close to capturing him at that point. But God knew the danger. God knew how long it would be before David would be caught up with. And in the right time, God sent the Philistines to distract Saul from it. And chapter 24, David is in En-Gedi, according to the end of chapter 23. En-Gedi is the region down by the Red Sea where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. The fact that it took 1,900 years to find them gives you some idea of how remote and inaccessible this region is. David was moving to the extremely barren, rugged, remote, inaccessible regions, mountainous, rocky regions of the Dead Sea region. As I say, if people couldn't find the Dead Sea Scrolls for 1,900 years while they're hidden there, it just shows how few people frequent the place and how little exploration is done there. Well, that's where David chose as his hiding place at this time. "Now it happened, when Saul had returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, 'Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi.'" So David had these people reporting on him all the time. He just couldn't stay anywhere very long. But Saul was detained for a while with the Philistines, but when he resumed his pursuit of David after that. "Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats." Now we later read of what kind of men were with David. In 2 Samuel, read of his mighty men and what kind of exploits they did. Some of them did mightier exploits even than David himself. David must have had an army approaching or exceeding 1,000 men probably by this time anyway. And Saul's bringing 3,000. And given the character and the ferocity of David's men, they might even be able to beat 3,000 men of Saul, but they don't even attempt it. They don't even try to engage him. Why? Because they're their countrymen. They're not at war against their own country. It's Saul who's the one dividing the country, not David. David has the interests of his nation in mind. Saul's not. So they never do seek to engage Saul in battle. They just keep running the other direction to keep a battle from happening. Verse 3, "So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs," to put it delicately. I think the Hebrew says he went to cover his feet, which is also putting it delicately. Covering the feet is a reference to oneself, and in particular, in the manner that requires you to crouch down. And so your feet are covered by your garments while you crouch in that manner. We encounter the same expression in the book of Judges, when Eglon's servants are wondering why his doors are locked, and they figure they won't disturb him. They say he's probably covering his feet. And it says that when the time went on and on and on, they got embarrassed. So they decided to bust in and check to see if he was okay, and sure enough, he was dead. But they got a little embarrassed that he'd be so long on the toilet. But anyway, covering the feet is a Hebrew expression for going to the bathroom, really. And so Saul had to do that, and you know, not wanting to do it out in the public. After all, he is a king. He needs to preserve his dignity. He went into this cave, not knowing that David and his men were staying in the recesses of the same cave. Man, what a dangerous situation for Saul. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day which the Lord, of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as seems good to you.'" Now, we don't read of God ever having said that to David, but he might have, through Gad or through some other. "And David arose and secretly cut off the corner of Saul's robe. Now, it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, and stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord.' So David restrained his servants with these words." Apparently, the servants wanted to kill Saul, too. "And he did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went his way. David also arose afterward and went out of the cave and called out to Saul, saying, 'My lord the king!' And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks you harm? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you, but my eye spared you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see, yes, see, the corner of your robe is in my hand. For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, but let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? Therefore let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see, and plead my case, and deliver me from your hand." Now, two things David brings up here, and that is that there are apparently people saying to Saul, "David seeks your harm," according to verse 9. Now, Saul had enough paranoia of his own without people telling that, but there must have been people who were opportunists saying, "Hey, David," I mean, they were probably jealous of David. He was exalted to high position above men who'd been in the army much longer than him, almost instantaneously. He enjoyed extremely, prestigious benefits, marrying the king's daughter and all that stuff. And there must have been people who resented David and were perpetrating this paranoia in Saul also, that there were people that David wanted. Saul might have actually been convinced of it by his own craziness and by the counsel of these people. And David says, "Listen, they're lying to you. Look, I had the chance to kill you. I didn't do it." The proverb he quotes, we don't know from other sources. In verse 13, "Wickedness proceeds from the wicked." Apparently it means wicked behavior can only be expected to come from wicked men. I'm not a wicked man, and my behavior has been shown to be righteous. You are doing wicked things. What does that make you? Basically he's implying you are a wicked man. I'm not. That's why I didn't kill you, and that's why you're trying to kill me. Wicked things are done by wicked people. "So it was, when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, 'Is this your voice, my son David?' And Saul lifted up his voice and wept." His heart was beating awfully fast, realizing how close he was to being killed and how vulnerable. And he was smitten in his conscience by the mercy David showed to him on this occasion. "Then he said to David, 'You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded you evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? Therefore may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done this day to me. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house.' So David swore to Saul, and Saul went home. But David and his men didn't go home." They went up to the stronghold, knowing that even though Saul swore against him anymore, there was certainly no reason to trust him. And sure enough, Saul came after him again later. Momentarily, Saul had his fits of sanity, and that interrupted his general insanity. But we'll see more on this next time. I don't know. I hope we may be able to finish 1 Samuel in the next session, but it's asking a lot. We'll see what we can do. Okay, that's all we've got time for.